Okay, then let's continue where we left off, and we'll turn to point 12. And I introduced this with the words more on the rationality and efficiency of the free market in responding to changes in economic conditions. There can be some situations in which the demand for some things goes up, the demand for other things goes down. And if they're produced with the same sorts of factors of production, there would be no lasting effect on relative prices. Imagine, for the sake of illustration, the demand for refrigerators rose and the demand for washing machines fell. Well, these things can probably be produced even in the same factories. They use the same sorts of materials, the same sorts of labor. So we could expand the supply of refrigerators from the same factors of production that we withdrew from the production of washing machines or whichever. And this would be a relatively simple situation. But let's deal now with a more complicated case where there's an increase in the demand for the kind of a product. Well, we have an increase in the demand for certain things, a decrease in the demand for other things, but the products in additional demand cannot be produced in larger quantity with factors of production released from the products in reduced demand. Let me give you immediately a concrete example. Suppose, for whatever reason, we had a rise in the demand for wristwatches, and people got the money for this by curtailing their expenditures on the rest of their wardrobes. So we have more money spent to buy wristwatches, less money spent to buy suits and dresses. Now, I pick this example because I think the types of people who are working in the garment industry would not be able to cross over and become watchmakers. So I'm assuming we have this rise in demand for watchmakers, a fall in demand for garment workers, or garment, the products of the garment industry, and there's no way to simply shift the factors of production from the one to the other, as in the case of the washing machine refrigerator example. All right, let's think through what will happen, because I want to develop this case to point out that in a free market, every change in the demand for or supply of any factor of production, as I put it here, is dealt with in a way that maximizes gains and minimizes losses. And I want to show how the maximization of gains and the minimization of losses is indicated in this example of a shift in demand from clothing to watches and the inability of the labor to move from the one to the other. All right, here we are. We have a rise in the demand for watches, and this is going to result in a rise in the demand for the services of watchmakers. What would be the effect of this on the wage rates of watchmakers? They'll go up. But now, there are some other groups of workers whose services could be used in watchmaking, workers in related fields where similar skills are required. Probably these would be workers making instruments of various types, perhaps workers in the optical goods industry. There'd be some other groups of workers whose services are such that perhaps with some retraining, it would not be all that out of the question to expand the supply of watches. All right, so here we are, to the extent that the wage rates of watchmakers rise, and workers in related lines have the ability to work as watchmakers, what will happen to the movement of labor from such lines as optical goods and instrument making into watchmaking? Okay, there'll be workers leaving instrument making, optical goods, whatever, and moving into the more remunerative field of watchmaking. All right, well, what is the effect of this on the wage rates of optical goods workers and instrument makers? They will go up. So now notice, we have a rise in the demand for a particular product, watches, that requires factors of production of a certain kind that are in limited supply. And it's the production of watches can be expanded at the expense of the production of other things using a group of workers of broadly similar skills. And the effect is to transmit the rise in demand for watches and watchmakers' labor into a rise in the wage rates of the broader category of labor, the workers in these related fields of optical goods and instrument making. And what will be the effect of their wage rates on the costs of production and then on the prices of instruments and optical goods? They will go up too. If the prices of instruments and optical goods are governed in any way by their costs of production, a rise in their costs proceeding from a rise in the wage rates of their workers, proceeding from a rise in the demand for watchmakers and their wage rates, that will raise the cost and prices of the optical goods and the instruments. And now, in response to the rise in the prices of optical goods, instruments, whatever, what's going to happen to the quantities of them demanded at their higher prices? There'll be less. Okay, now, can anyone see what in the last analysis is determining the extent to which watchmaking expands at the expense of the allied lines using the same sorts of factors of production? To what extent, what will determine the extent to which watchmaking expands at the expense of optical goods, or more specifically, eyeglasses of different types? At what extent it expands at the expense of the production of various types of instruments? Is this chaos? Is it random? Or is there any principle determining the extent to which watchmaking expands at the expense of the related lines?
Uniformity to profit.
Well, you say uniformity to profit. Can anyone think of anything else here? Pardon me? It'll be based on the demand. In response to the higher prices of instruments, optical goods, etc., the consumers curtail their purchases. Now, which of the items they previously had been able to purchase will they dispense with in terms of their importance? Yes?
Probably the watches.
No, they want, that we start off, they want more watches.
The optical goods.
Less clothes.
Pardon me?
We were talking about the garment.
Well, they've spent less on clothes, but the garment workers cannot be used to enlarge the supply of watches. They lack the necessary skills. They can't acquire the necessary skills. The workers who could enlarge the supply of watches are optical goods workers, instrument makers, people of that kind. And the question I'm now raising is, what will determine the extent to which the additional labor for watchmaking is released from instrument making or from optical goods or both or any other field?
The demand.
Now, in connection with the demand, which goods will the consumers dispense with in response to the higher prices? Which optical goods, which instruments will they give up that they previously could afford? Those they consider the most important or those they consider the least important? Okay, so notice the additional labor for the expansion of watches will be drawn from the previously marginal employments of this broader category of labor. The labor required for the expansion of watchmaking will come from the previously marginal employments of such labor. That might mean coming from the making of specialty sunglasses, telescopes for amateur astronomers. It'll be the market which decides. So you notice, if the rise in demand for watches and the services of watchmakers ends up raising the prices of eyeglasses, well, how, in what way will consumers cut back on their purchase of eyeglasses? Maybe they would have purchased two pair of reading glasses and a pair of sunglasses. Now the price is higher. They'll discontinue one of these things. Which one will they discontinue?
Sunglasses.
Whatever they consider the least important. So for some people it's sunglasses, for some it may be the second pair of reading glasses. It'll differ from person to person. Other people, faced with a higher price of instruments, That means hobbyists pursuing home astronomy, they have to pay more for telescopes. Well, maybe they'll give up the telescopes or buy smaller, cheaper ones. The wider principle is the labor made available for the expansion of watchmaking will come from the previously marginal employments of that labor, the least important of the employments to which it was previously devoted, the least important among the most important employments. Okay, now, how does this example differ in outcome from instead of being initiated by an enlargement in the demand for one of the types of products and labor, suppose simply there was a reduction in the supply of such labor. Instead of there being a greater demand for the whole category of such labor, we had, and having to take it from its previously marginal uses, suppose we had a reduction in the supply of such labor, the broader supply of people possessing this set of skills. Pardon me?
Would you have very highly skilled people?
Yes, we'd have very highly skilled people doing this work, but let's suppose some disease spreads among them. They get a virus from some of their microscopes or whatever, and their number is reduced to a certain degree. Now we have fewer such workers. What will happen to their wage rates? The wage rates will go up. Now, it doesn't matter in which specific line this originated, whether it was in the watchmaking line or it was in instrument making or wherever. There's less of the labor overall. What will be the effect of a rise in the wage rates of any component, any portion of this category of labor on the wage rates of the others? They'll go up. And now, even though most of the workers lost might have been lost in one particular line, does that mean that that line will bear the whole burden of the reduction in this supply of labor? What happens as the wage rates of that supply of labor go up?
It'll attract
labor labor from the related lines. Okay, now, from which lines will the labor be released? What's going to determine which of these various lines releases labor given the overall reduction in the supply of labor?
The least important.
So whether there is an increase in the demand for labor of a given type or a decrease in the supply of such labor, in both cases, some of this labor will have to be moved from certain employments to other employments. In one case, it has to be moved to satisfy the additional demand for watches. In the other case, it has to be moved to make up for a reduction in the supply, perhaps of instrument workers. In both cases, where does the loss get taken out? The least important. Anytime there is an increase in the demand or a decrease in the supply that is no longer available will be at the expense of the previously marginal employments. And there will be a supply no longer available to expand watchmaking. That supply is no longer available in instrument making and optical goods, and it'll be taken from the least important employments there. So, and this will of course apply not just to labor in scarce supply, but to anything. It'll apply to crude oil in scarce supply. In a free market, if we have a reduction in the supply of crude oil, what's the effect on the price of crude oil? It goes up. What's the effect on the price of all oil products? It goes up. Now, the rise in the price of all oil products will have to be sufficient so that the reduction in quantity demanded of the various oil products will result in a reduction in the quantity demanded of oil equal to the reduction in the supply of oil. Now, where is the supply reduction carried out in a free market? From which oil products, and to what extent will there be a reduction in supply made available?
The least important oil products.
In the least important, in the previously marginal oil products, as indicated by where the consumers cut back in response to the higher prices. Now, what sort of thing goes into the outcome? What will the consumers be considering, and the people along the way, all of the business users of oil, As the price of oil is rising to them, that represents rising costs of production, and they'll want to minimize the rise in costs. So what will business firms be doing in determining their own responses?
They cut down on the least important expenses.
Well, how will they know, what considerations will decide if a previous use of oil is not particularly important and can more or less easily be dispensed with?
One with the least demand.
Pardon me?
The one with the least demand.
Well, what will determine the extent of the demand of a business firm for oil products? Now, they might be considering, for one thing they would certainly consider is, do they have any alternatives to the use of this oil product, at least in its previous quantity? So imagine you were the shipping manager of a firm, and you're faced with the higher transportation costs, the higher costs of shipping your products. So you know that truckers' rates have gone up. What will you be looking at if it's possibly available? Do you have any alternative methods of shipping? If rail rates have not gone up so much, or there's barge transportation available, you'll switch based on whichever has the least rise in costs. Now, maybe you don't have an alternative, and you have to simply pass through the higher cost. And maybe you can't pass it through. And if you can't pass it through, maybe you're just plain unprofitable. Well, then what happens? Then your operation will stop. Those operations will stop, which the consumers are unwilling to compensate with sufficiently higher prices for their products. So it might be we have a company using various oil products to produce widgets, and the consumers are unwilling to allow a sufficient rise in the price of widgets to make the operations of this company profitable, even to cover its operating costs, in which case, what will happen to its production of widgets? It will cease. And so there you have a reduction in the quantity demanded of oil. The consumers have decided this particular oil-using product is not sufficiently important. We're not going to allow prices that would cover the higher cost, and the thing is flat out unprofitable, doesn't even cover the operating costs. And so that is partly a way of reducing the quantity demanded toward the reduction in supply available. Always, the quantity demand, the areas that will cut back their consumption are those that have ready alternatives available, where the loss can be dealt with most easily, and those products which the consumers consider insufficiently important to continue in the light of the higher necessary price. Yes, Mike.
Okay, I'm missing the connection between where you're talking about the workers, say, making clothing, and consumers now having a higher demand for, say, watches. I mean, the connection between the obstacles, all the other instruments, and all those things.
Yeah.
The pressure of production, I can see how that shifts.
Yeah.
But what happens to the workers that can't shift from the...
Okay, very good question. That's part of the analysis, too, and I've neglected that so far. So let's immediately turn to that. Where do the garment workers go? Now, these ex-garment workers will be fanning out into many different areas. Each of them will be considering, what else could I do besides be a garment worker? And then, to the extent there's more than one opportunity, which of the different possible opportunities open to them do you think they're going to choose? They're going to have to take lower wages, but let's say up to now they had been making $500 a week working as a garment worker. Now they're going to have to take less. If they become a restaurant worker, a particular one, he can make $400 a week doing yet something else. He can make $300 a week. Which do you think he's going to go for? that which represents the least fall in his income, and what areas will be able to absorb these former garment workers with the least fall in their wage rates. It'll be those areas where the consumers are prepared to expand their quantities demanded with the least fall in prices. It'll be those areas where the consumers are prepared to buy more with the least fall in prices. That's where the garment workers will end up going. Some of them will end up as restaurant workers if the consumers are willing to absorb extra restaurant workers, and they will if there's some fall in wage rates in the prices of what they have to pay. And there are other areas where the consumers will absorb additional labor only if there's a more precipitous fall in price and thus in wages. So as between uses which require a bigger drop in price to find additional quantities demanded, and uses which require a smaller drop in price to find additional quantities demanded, which do you think the consumers consider more important? If we have, let's say, two different goods, in one case, consumers will buy more of this good at some reduction in prices, but the lower prices still permit the employers to pay the ex-garment workers $400. In other cases, the consumers will buy additional goods requiring services, comparable services of ex-garment workers, but only at prices that permit wages of $300. Which do you think implies a higher valuation on the part of the consumers? The higher, which represents the higher valuation of the consumers? A use which they're willing to allow $400 for, or a use they're willing to allow $300 for? Which do you value more, something you're willing to pay up to $400 for, or something you're willing to pay up to $300 for? Obviously $400. So the garment workers, in fanning out into those uses that can absorb them at the least fall in wage rates compared to what they had been earning, those will be the uses where the consumers are willing to absorb the resulting additional quantities of products or services at the least fall in price. Now, these represent the most important of the previously submarginal uses for this type of labor. If we have a lesser demand for garment workers, that makes their services available for other uses that the same sort of labor can provide. And the uses into which that labor will be absorbed are those that are the most important among the uses that the labor was previously unavailable for because it was working producing garments. So factors of production in reduced demand, like the garment workers, they are channeled into the most important of their previously submarginal employments. They're absorbed in the most important of their previously submarginal employments. Those are the employments that can absorb them with the least fall in their wage rates. Now, how does this case differ from having a larger supply of such workers? Suppose the demand for garment workers had not fallen, and we just ended up having a larger supply of that same type of labor, equivalent to the labor that was released by the fall in the demand for clothing. Where would the additional labor be absorbed? There are some uses for the additional labor where you can only use it profitably if you're paying that labor 50 cents an hour. There are other uses, perhaps, where you can absorb the labor profitably paying $5 an hour. Which of the uses do you think those workers will be going into? The highest they can find, and the ones that will be the highest are the ones that can use the additional labor with in the ways that the consumers most value. So when you have factors of production in limited supply now available, either in a larger overall supply or are faced with a reduced demand, either way, the supply that is newly available, the new additional supply or the part of the supply that was previously used somewhere else and is now released, the newly available supply will be absorbed in the most important of its previously submarginal uses. Now, this is why I say that putting these two examples together, the free market responds to events in a way that maximizes gains and minimizes losses. When we have a supply of something made newly available, either because there is an increase in the overall total supply or because part of the supply is no longer required for a previous use, that's the garment worker example, where does the supply newly available get used? In the uses that can absorb it with the least decline in the incomes of the sellers. That's the most important of the uses previously not provided for. If we have a diminished supply, or we have an additional demand for something that requires that part of the supply be taken away from uses previously provided for, where does the supply no longer available get drawn from? You already answered the question. When we have a reduced supply of something or an additional demand for that same item, and then part of the supply is no longer available for previous uses, like the labor of optical goods workers and instrument makers, because they're needed to expand the production of watches, where does the supply that is no longer available get drawn from? Where will its use be curtailed to match the lack of availability of supply? Yes? The least important of the previously covered uses. So decreases in supply or increases in demand for a factor of production in limited supply, they are met with the least possible loss. They're drawn from the least important of the employments previously covered by that supply. When we have an enlarged supply, either because the overall supply is greater or because a part of the previous supply is released due to a diminution in demand somewhere, the supply newly available goes to the most important of the employments previously not provided for. So additions to supply go to the most important of the previously submarginal employments. Diminutions in supply come from the least important of the previously marginal employments. They come from the previously marginal employments. This is how the free market responds. So if, for example, we have to cope with less oil, then the reduction in the supply will be drawn from those uses which are the least important of the uses of oil that we have previously provided for. And in the process, what will be involved in determining what these uses are, everybody in the system, whether in business or as a consumer, will be contemplating what alternatives do they have to the use of these oil products. They see the higher price of oil, and that makes them sit up and take notice, and they have to decide, how much do I want to continue using so much of this? What alternatives do I have, if any? And to the extent that people have alternatives, like in the face of a higher price of gasoline, there'll be some people whose alternative might be they could carpool. Or there'll be other people, if they live in an area with other kinds of transportation, they might decide to take a bus or a subway or whatever. Business firms might decide, if they have different factories in different parts of the country and their heating bills are sharply increasing, They might decide they'll concentrate their production in areas that aren't as cold to hold down the cost. Or they change their shipping methods. Or in some cases, they have to cease operations. But overall, the outcome, if, for example, there's 1 million barrels of oil per day less that would be available, if that's the grand total, then somewhere there has to be 1 million barrels of oil a day no longer consumed. And that will mean there's somewhat less production of gasoline, somewhat less production of heating oil, jet fuel, propane, butane, et cetera, et cetera. And what's going to determine to what extent there's less in each of these different possible uses? It'll be where the demand for the resulting products is cut back, where there are no readily available substitutes. The outcome will be determined literally by the thinking and consideration and planning of all the users of oil and oil products in the economic system. The total of 1 million barrels of oil a day less will end up being the outcome of what, in many, many cases, is the saving of a pint or quart here and there on the part of vast numbers of individuals. Now, finally, I turn to point 13, more on the harmonious integration of all production and consumption in a free market. We've actually, I think, if I'm not mistaken, already dealt with the significance of using lower-priced factors in place of higher-priced factors. If not, perhaps, does anyone recall that discussion? Do we have it? What's this? Suppose you can find that they're now able to substitute aluminum for silver, let's say, in some industrial use. And silver is $6 an ounce, and aluminum is what? Does anyone know the price of aluminum? A dollar a pound or something like that? Radically cheaper than silver. All right, if that is their relative prices, $6 an ounce and $1 a pound, what does that signify about the marginal utility of an ounce of silver versus a pound of aluminum? It's substantially higher, right? Well, now, to the extent that we could substitute aluminum for silver, even if it took a pound of aluminum to substitute for an ounce of silver, if it's an ounce for ounce, that's even less. If we can substitute a pound of aluminum for an ounce of silver, what is the silver made available for? And what is the aluminum no longer available for? Okay, now, when the silver is made available, what will happen to the price of silver? If initially it was $6, but part of silver will drop and aluminum will go up somewhat. There's a greater demand for aluminum, a lesser demand for silver, but still it's extremely unlikely that their valuations would cross. The silver now maybe $5.75 an ounce, and the aluminum perhaps $1.20 a pound or something like that. So what is signified if we withdraw something that has a marginal utility of no more than $1.20, and we make available something with a marginal utility of $5.75? What is signified about the extent of the value gained versus the value lost from the perspective of the ultimate consumers? Does it signify being better off if you can have more of something that people value as highly as $5.75 an ounce and a little bit less of something that they value at $1.20 a pound? Don't you think that that would signify an improvement? It would be increasing the supply of something more valuable at the expense of decreasing the supply of something less valuable. That should represent a net gain. And that is the outcome anytime you can substitute a lower-priced factor of production for a higher-priced factor of production and achieve the same results. Another example of the same situation would be substituting for the labor of a physician, the labor of an x-ray technician in reading or in taking the x-rays. At one time, I think, physicians had to take their own x-rays. Now, if you can substitute an x-ray technician to take the x-rays instead of the physician doing it, what's gained and what's lost? And more time for the physician to do things like perform diagnoses. We're increasing.
For the technician.
Pardon me?
More money for the technician performing a higher end task.
Okay, there's an improvement for the technician. Now, if this change had not occurred, where would the technician be? He'd be doing something else. Maybe he'd be a clerk somewhere. Who knows? The way things stand, we gain the additional diagnostic services of a physician, which are very highly valued, and we lose the services of a clerk. The services that we lose might even have been much less valuable if at the same time there are developments going on that make it possible to get by with fewer clerks. So we're gaining, there's a net gain in the valuable services of physicians, a much greater gain than loss of alternative services or products. And that's the outcome anytime you're able to use an equally good, less expensive factor of production in place of a more expensive factor. Now this is something that's not generally seen. I mean, obviously businessmen are concerned to the best of their ability. Anytime they can find an equally good, less expensive way of doing something, they'll do it. But I don't think very many of them are aware of the wider social implications of their behavior, and still fewer people in the general society are. They don't see a concern with holding down costs as a means of contributing to the expansion in production in the economic system. Now, further development along these same lines, I mentioned the significance of cost calculations. Now, very, very often, perhaps more often than not, there's more than one way to produce a given good, more than one way to accomplish a given result. For example, suppose your objective is to get across a body of water. Well, one possible way is to build a bridge across the body of water. Or you could tunnel under the water. Or you could have a ferry boat line. Or you could detour around the body of water. These are different possible ways. And you could locate the bridge or the tunnel at different points. Those are more possibilities. You might have different designs. You can have different types of bridges and so forth. Similarly, when you generate electric power, you could do it in some instances through falling water, or you could use solar power. You could have coal-fired plants, oil-fired plants, gas-fired plants, atomic plants. They're all different possibilities, and each of these has probably several different variations of design. Now, other things being equal, which will the business firms in question want to choose? Which methods will they want? Yes? Is there any uncertainty as to which they would prefer, other things being equal? The lowest cost method. They prefer the lowest cost method. Now, the fact that a method is lower cost has a major, wider economic, social significance. It means the lower cost method is the method that has the least adverse impact economically on the rest of the system. It withdraws the least valued combination of factors of production at the margin. It makes possible this given result in a way that interferes least with the ability to produce in the rest of the economy, as indicated by the sum of the prices of the factors of production. The reason one method has a lower cost than another method is the result of the fact either that it's able to use smaller quantities of the factors of production or less valuable factors of production. Either way, to the extent that it succeeds at its lower cost by being able to use smaller quantities, what is obviously the effect on the ability to produce in the rest of the economy? that's greater. Factors of production are left over to produce in other lines. To the extent that the lower cost is based on using less valued factors of production, well, that means it's making the more valued factors of production available for other things. It's accomplishing this result by the withdrawal of relatively low-valued factors of production and leaving the more highly valued factors of production available for other things. Now, this is something very few people have realized, I think, but the cost of accomplishing anything is an indication of its overall economic impact. The cost of achieving any given result is the indicator of its overall economic impact. And following the lowest cost methods, which is what businessmen are automatically doing based on the profit motive, that means the production of each particular item is geared in such a way that it permits the greatest production in the rest of the economy. It has the least adverse economic impact on the rest of the economy. And I think this is something almost totally ignored. There's very little discussion of economic impacts, much less realization that costs are the indicator of economic impact. Instead, we have concentration on such things as environmental impact that no one could truly describe to begin with. And there are demands that there be the minimal environmental impact irrespective of the cost, which means irrespective of the economic impact. And I have a last statement here, what the prices of consumers' goods reflect. Well, they reflect the degree of scarcity of the item itself together with the valuations of all of the buyers and potential buyers. But also, where you have consumers' goods that come from factors of production in scarce supply, like gasoline coming from oil, the price of gasoline is indirectly an indicator of the overall supply of crude oil and the demand not only for gasoline, but for all the other oil products. The demand for all the oil products factors into the demand for oil and thus into the price of oil, which comes back via cost into the price of gasoline. And so the price of something like gasoline, whether one is aware of it or not, is an indicator indirectly of the overall supply of crude oil and of the demand for all of the different oil products. Okay, let me pause here and ask if we have any questions. I know some of this may be a little difficult, but I don't think it's all that difficult. Well, I hope you all have with you Supplement 5. I didn't realize I was going to get this far tonight, so I perhaps should have, had I known it, I would have sent you all an email and told you to bring Supplement 5. By all means, bring it next week. All right, what we've done up to this point, I think, is hopefully gained some understanding of the fundamental principles of price formation in a free market, starting with the demand and supply in terms of schedules and curves, and then on to the uniformity of profit principle, the power it gives to consumers, its dynamic element of bringing about continuous improvements in production, and the geographic uniformity of prices, the temporal uniformity of principle, the principles pertaining to wage rates, the relationship between prices and costs, and now tonight these further principles on demand and supply. And in the light of all this, we're now in a position to consider interferences in the free market in the form of price controls and their offspring shortages. And these discussions, I think, will help to confirm and reinforce the value of the free market. And while price controls do not have tremendous immediate topical relevance. There are some instances of price controls, notably rent controls. It's not at all unlikely that within not too many years there'll be further examples of price controls, or at least widespread demands for their imposition, and we'll be lucky to avoid their imposition. And that's to be expected if you have a society with very, very little understanding of how the price system operates or what it accomplishes. I think the way most people see prices is they think prices are arbitrarily set by the sellers at the expense of the average consumer, especially when we have prices rising. People tend to blame businessmen for the rise in prices. They think the rise is arbitrary without any foundation or justification. And they then look to the government as the agent to put the businessmen down. I don't think, in fact, the way I think people look at matters is not very different than the way our ancestors centuries ago looked at the physical world. You know, it hasn't always been the case that people regarded the physical world as lawful, as functioning according to natural laws of physics and mathematics. Try to think of the mentality for a moment of people in the Dark Ages. And the screen went off. Thank you. Try to think for a moment of the mentality of people in the Dark Ages. And perhaps they'd have a flood and someone's little hut would be washed away, or his oxen or whatever contracted some disease and perished. What kind of reaction might we expect such people to have? What kind of explanation would they have of these terrible phenomena? And what sort of remedy would they seek to deal with them? You think their explanation would be, oh, we had floods because there was tremendous snowfall in the mountains over the winter, and we had an early spring with high temperatures. So we had a lot of melted snow that produced the floods, perfectly understandable. And we have the disease because there are certain germs which are carried by certain bugs or whatever that bite the animals. They die, maybe people die. Do you think the explanation would run along those lines? I don't think so. So what sort of explanation do you think they'd have?
Religious.
Something along religious lines, in a way, broadly considered. How would they view their ills? What, from where did they come? Well, there are evil forces working in the world out to harm them. And what would be their source of protection?
The church.
Okay, it could be the church or some sort of a mystical remedy. They'd want bigger, tougher, more powerful spirits to intervene on their side against the evil forces that were harming them. Is this unfamiliar? Does it ring any kind of bell? Or
isn't that what happened with the Salem witch trials?
Okay, it would be the same sort of mentality, the same kind of mentality. People would think that their ills, their physical ills, coming from the physical world, that they were the result of evil spirits. And their protection and the remedy lay in gaining the support of bigger, tougher, more powerful spirits. It's the old classic war between the devil and God, God and the devil. Well, how does that mentality differ from the way so many people view big business and government? They think here's big business, there the evil forces conspiring at any moment to depress the people's wages, raise the prices they pay, poison their foods, give them unsafe buildings, dangerous drugs. And what's their remedy?
Government.
The government. That's the bigger, tougher, good spirit. And that's, so I think people are viewing the economic world in a way very similar to the way our ancestors viewed the physical world. And the reason they can view it that way is they have no knowledge of economic law. They have no knowledge of the fact that such things as price determination, the whole functioning of the economic system, is lawful in the same way that the physical world is lawful. The general cultural understanding has not reached the point of realizing that the concept of natural law applies to relations among human beings and in the economic realm as well as in the physical realm. In fact, there may be some indications they're losing it again in the physical realm. Okay, so it's in the light of that background that when things start to go bad, if prices start rising, people are prepared to blame business, and they demand as the solution the government to intervene. Or if anything bad is happening, the solution, according to most of our contemporaries, is to have the government intervene. All right, well, let's turn now to price controls and shortages and start with the distinction between shortages and scarcities. Often these two are treated as though they were the same phenomenon. They're actually very, very distinct. Scarcity refers to limitation of supply. Scarcity refers to limitation of supply. You can have things which are extremely limited in supply, like gold and diamonds, and there need be no shortage of them. There will be no shortage if you have a free market. What will stop the shortage? A shortage being a situation in which people are attempting to buy more of something than is available for sale or exists.
More supply.
Pardon me?
More supply.
More supply as what?
In relation to demand.
It rises.
What prevents a shortage, despite a scarcity, is the freedom of the price to rise. See, here we are. The world's annual production of gold, I think, is possibly 60 million ounces, not much more than that, conceivably 80 million ounces. Now, that doesn't add up to very much if you compare it to the annual production of iron or copper or whatever. There's so very little of it, but anyone who's prepared to pay the prevailing market price of gold can obtain all the gold that he wants. See, what is it that limits the quantity of gold demanded to the very limited annual production that takes place?
The
height of the price, over $400 an ounce. So at $400 an ounce, that rules out all kinds of possible uses for gold, all sorts of uses that are technologically possible, but they're just too expensive. And similarly with diamonds. There's no shortage of these things, even though they're incredibly scarce. Now, a shortage is a situation in which buyers are attempting to buy more than sellers are prepared to sell, typically more than sellers have available to sell. Now, the only thing that keeps a shortage in existence is that the price is prohibited from rising sufficiently to reduce the quantity demanded to the supply available. The only thing that explains a shortage is a price control. And you could have price controls creating shortages even of the things that we think of as the most abundant. We could have a record high grain harvest, and we could still create a shortage of it through price controls. How? Well, suppose we had a price control that put the price of grain at a point where it now appeared profitable to use it to start feeding animals in feedlots on a large scale. Well, how much can they eat? They can eat huge quantities such that record high grain crops would not be sufficient. And then we'd have a shortage of grain in the midst of record abundance. As a matter of fact, when we had the oil shortage in the United States, the situation was not fundamentally different. And if we had an oil shortage now, the situation would not be fundamentally different. If you consider the per capita consumption of oil in the United States compared to the per capita consumption of oil in most parts of the world at the present time, how does it stand? It's very, very high, right? And if you considered the per capita consumption of the United States today compared to past years, I'm sure it's very, very high. Now, suppose our supply were 5 or 10% less, which it could easily become given some of the developments going on in the world, and we had a price control. So prices would be frozen about where they are right now, but we have 5 or 10% less supply available. Well, with the same set of prices, how much oil would people be attempting to obtain?
Same
as they're now doing, but they'd be 5 or 10% less. So what situation would exist?
Shortage.
A shortage. And we'd have that shortage, even though from the point of view of most of the rest of the world and the point of view of most of modern economic history, our supplies of oil per capita are at extremely high levels and still would be even if they were 5 or 10% less. So we'd have a shortage in the face of very great physical abundance. Well, what would explain the shortage?
The price control.
If we didn't have the price control, even though the supply diminished, a diminution in supply would not cause a shortage. What would it cause? Which would stop the shortage? Which would stop? It would cause a rise in price. At the rise in price, the quantity demanded would be reduced to the same extent as the supply available, so no shortage would result. Now, let me try to explain this next point. Scarcities do not cause shortages. Well, I've actually explained that. Scarcities by themselves cause higher prices. In the face of the higher prices, the quantity demanded is reduced to whatever extent needed to make it commensurate with the reduced supply. But then I add, shortages cause scarcities. Well, shortages make scarcities worse by their disruptive effects on production. With shortages, the fact that the price is not allowed to rise, that allows the item to go on being used for previously marginal purposes, and at the same time, the supply may now be unavailable for the most vital and urgent purposes. So just think, if we have 5% less supply, and the least important of the uses are still being provided for, somewhere there has to be a reduction in usage. Only because the price is prohibited from rising, the reduction in usage will not be at the expense of the previously marginal employments. It might well be at the expense of the utmost vitally important employments. And exactly that is what happened in the oil shortage that we had back in the 70s. Now, I know some people complain, why do I talk about the oil shortage in the 70s? Because happily, there was no oil shortage in the 80s or 90s. There are some things which the negative developments, thankfully, are not yet occurring on a continuing basis. So thankfully, our last experience of this kind was in the 1970s. Now, in the first oil shortage, the major one, the more protracted one, which occurred in 73, 74, there were actually news stories about oil rigs off the coast of Louisiana being threatened with having to shut down because they lacked certain oil products necessary to their continued operation. I suppose they were lubricants of some kind. Now, just think about this for a moment. Here you are. You have a functioning oil well. It's turning out, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of barrels of oil per day, and it needs a few drops of oil to keep its parts working smoothly. And they can't get it because there's a shortage. Well, where is the oil that they would need? Someone else has it. Now, what? Just think about the fact, is there any use for oil products that would be in a position to outbid an oil well for the use of oil?
Probably not. Very rarely.
I doubt that anything could. If for a few drops, you're producing hundreds of gallons, you can pay any price practically, much higher than virtually anybody else. So in a free market, there could never have remotely been a question of oil rigs being threatened with shutdown for lack of any sort of oil supplies. But when you have a price control, the most marginal use of oil can still go on affording it. And if it continues to be supplied, someone else somewhere has to do without, and that party can end up being oil fields, oil rigs. Now, the oil rigs didn't have to shut down, but the only thing that permitted them not to was there was some special executive order, perhaps by the governor of Louisiana, I forget just whom, mandating the shipment of the necessary oil supplies to them. But it took this special directive to keep them going. Another example along the same lines, a little less extreme, there were truckers delivering food supplies to southern Florida who refused to go ahead and deliver them because they were afraid in the face of the shortage of diesel fuel and gasoline that on their way back up the Florida Peninsula they wouldn't be able to find fuel. Now just think, here we are, people delivering food supplies. Now, if you had a free market price of fuel, let's say the price is going to be stiff, but what's required to compensate the truckers for their higher fuel costs when we get to, down to cans of peas and so forth? A somewhat higher price, maybe a penny a can for this and that. Do you think that the delivery of food supplies would have been an item sacrificed because of the diminution in the supply of oil that we had? If we had a free market and the truckers were able to outbid the marginal users of oil? No. So a major consequence of price controls in depriving the market of its means of adjusting quantity demanded to the supply available is that it literally makes it possible for the most marginal employments of a product or factor of production to go on continuing to be served at the expense of the most vital and urgent employments. And to the extent that that happens, what do you think happens to production? If we had had the oil rigs actually shutting down for lack of oil products to keep them going, what would that have done to the production of oil? It would have decreased, made the scarcity worse, much worse. Well, it's in the nature of price controls and shortages by causing such economic chaos to reduce the ability of the system to produce, diminish supplies, make scarcities greater. So this is why I say price controls cause shortages. Not only cause shortages, price controls cause scarcities. They make scarcities worse. They interfere with production by misallocating supplies of factors of production. Yes, Mr. Say.
I have a hard time reconciling something that happened last year with the lithium ion, which is used in the batteries.
Yeah.
The laptop and the cell phones. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you understand that at some point a year ago, one of the African producers decided to shut down the production. And a lot of the Japanese suppliers of these battery cells started to raise the prices on the computer makers and the cell phone manufacturers, et cetera, et cetera. So on the surface, sure, you know, we're looking at this as a case where the producers, in this case the suppliers, are jacking up prices by manipulating their production. And to the best of my knowledge, there's no price control on the lithium ion.
So
as a result, there was a lot of shortage for the battery product. I don't think we should look at my application. And based on what I see, it's not due to any price control. So literally, it was a quote-unquote evil practice by the producer.
Okay, now you said a shortage. I want to be clear on two things. You started by saying an African supplier of some basic material went out of business, stopped supplying.
I don't know the background of whether it was, it went out of business or it was just a business decision.
Okay, all right. So there was a reduction in something
reduction,
required to produce these ion batteries,
lithium
ion batteries. Okay.
So there's no price control there.
I mean, there's no price control, but there's a reduction in the supply for whatever reason.
And therefore it costs short.
Okay, now, what happened to the price of these batteries and why? Now, when you say shortage, do you mean that there was a situation where there are people out seeking to buy these batteries, willing to pay the market price, but they couldn't obtain the batteries?
Correct.
Well, what would have happened had they offered more money?
Well, you have a lot of applications out there that require them. So if there's limited supply, because the foundry decides to shut down, you reach a point where there's just simply not enough.
Yeah.
At least in the short term.
Okay. Now, there was no market of any kind where you could obtain these batteries at a higher price? Well, you see, what I could visualize is perhaps the manufacturers of the batteries, maybe they had contractual commitments. Was this the case, that there were contractual commitments to sell the computer manufacturers, laptop manufacturers, etc., batteries at a contractually set price, and then they just couldn't deliver? That could happen.
I can only speak from the electronic product.
Okay.
Position.
All right, so you're in a company producing some electronic product that needs these batteries, right? Now, did your company have some agreement with a supplier to receive batteries at a contractually given price?
Not a set price.
Not at any set price.
No.
And was anyone getting any batteries anywhere?
Eventually.
Well, it wasn't the case that there was zero batteries in the market, right?
Correct.
Okay. So now, in these cases, I would still say that whoever would offer a higher price would get batteries. It might have to be a steeply higher price. It might have to be someone is getting his batteries, but at a sufficiently high price, he'll give them to you. There had to be something preventing a rise in price.
No, that would also mean that someone elsewhere won't be getting their batteries, right?
Well, yes, but if it's someone who's, let's say, entitled to get certain batteries contractually, you could buy his right, give him a price that will make him be glad to let you have the batteries.
But there still is a shortage.
No, there would not be a shortage then, because here we are. Let's say we have two companies. You're counting on some batteries. Another company is counting on the batteries. Company have them. We're happy taking your money. You wouldn't have a quantity demanded greater than supply available if the price could rise. Now, maybe there was something preventing the price from rising. I don't know what that could be. Because in these situations, I would assume there would be some market where there'd be people who were getting certain shipments, and at a high enough price, they'd be willing to let others have them. So you could have a situation where if it's considered temporary, the makers of the batteries want to maintain a long-term market, and if they think they're in a position to get back to the normal battery prices and with an adequate supply, they might be reluctant to raise their prices. They might say to their customers, wait a while, we can't supply you now. But if the customers truly wanted it, they could get batteries, but they'd have to pay a higher price.
So do you think, like, perhaps there is some sort of a pricing issue between the cell manufacturer and the foundry?
And the what?
The foundries, or the producers of the source of these chemicals, or whatever you call them. But at that level, there could be some sort of a...
Well, I would think it would be more, as I understand it so far, between the manufacturers of the batteries and the product, the end users, the laptop makers, the iPod makers, or whatever.
No, my question is whether there is some sort of a pricing degree, because between, let's say, the iPod maker and the battery manufacturer, there is a pricing.
There's no pricing agreement.
There's no price control thing. So
okay.
There could be at the other.
Okay. Well, you see, if there is no price control of any kind, then I would have great difficulty understanding why the price didn't just go up.
It did.
Well, if it did, then there wouldn't be a shortage unless the price didn't go up very much or not enough.
A shortage
is a situation in which, at the prevailing price, buyers are seeking to buy more than is available. And buyers will seek to buy less if the price goes up. Now, maybe they won't seek to buy less if the price goes up just a little bit in certain circumstances, but certainly the price is capable of rising sufficiently so that whatever the supply in the market may be, that's all the buyers will seek. So anyone able and willing to pay that price, however high it may be, will be able to get the supply. You'll be able to get whatever the supply may be. Now, just ask yourself this. Think in terms of an auction. I think this gets to the essence of it. Here we are, we have an auction, and there's one item up for auction, and initially there's 100 bidders. Will there continue to be more bidders than there are units as the auction progresses? There'll be fewer and fewer bidders until what? Even now, here we have a case, there's only one unit. We started with 100 bidders. How many bidders will we end with?
One.
One, because the price will be high enough so that it's too high for all bidders but one. Now, if we have two units, the price will be high enough so it's too high for all bidders but two. If we have 2 million units, it'll be high enough, so it's too high for all bidders but for these 2 million. Now, if we have a situation where normally there's 100 million units, and then for some reason there's 50 million units, well, initially the price was such that 100 million units could be afforded. Now, the price should rise so high that only 50 million units can be afforded. Unless there's some kind of restraint preventing the price from rising. And incidentally, if the price did not rise, you couldn't look to any kind of manipulation motive. You see, what you might find occasionally is, if there's a very rare material and its price will go up if its supply is reduced, it could, in some circumstances, pay the producers to reduce the supply, but only if they can succeed in driving the price up. See, you might have a cartel arrangement sometimes. You might have one firm controlling the whole supply. Like De Beers, for many years, that's a cartel of diamond producers. They maintain a high price of diamonds by restricting the supply of diamonds. They deliberately hold back diamonds to make them scarcer in the market. Does that create a shortage of diamonds? Why not?
Somebody's controlling the
market. The price is going up.
Because the price goes up to the point of reducing the quantity demanded to the limited supply available. Now, if something analogous were to happen in the making of lithium-ion batteries, then the only possible explanation of anyone doing this would be that he hoped to get a higher price. But at that higher price, there would be no shortage. The item would be scarcer, more expensive, but it wouldn't be in a state of shortage. A shortage exists when the supply is reduced and the price is not allowed to rise. That's what would create the shortage. I now, I want to try as fast as possible to explain the various ways that price controls create shortages. Once they do create shortages, then as I've indicated in these examples of the Louisiana oil rigs and the trucking, the food shipments to southern Florida, once you have a state of shortages, then production can decline further just because of the economic chaos entailed in shortages, something we'll investigate in considerable detail probably next week. It has to be next week. But first I want to go into how it is that price controls create shortages. They do so by artificially enlarging the quantity of a good demanded. I think we've seen that. If you hold the price down, you're allowing the quantity demanded to be maintained, not to be restricted to the supply available. But now let's briefly consider the various ways that price controls also reduce supply, apart from their further devastating way via having created shortages. Well, one very obvious way is insofar as they make the production of a good unprofitable. And this occurs particularly if you have a period of inflation. Take rent control and the price controls we had back in years past on oil. You could also have the same thing on electric power or anything where there's a controlled price. If we have inflation, what will inflation be doing to the costs of production of these items under price control? It increases it. And then what does that do to the ability of such firms to save and reinvest to meet growth in demand? They can't do it. So you have growing demand and the inability of supply to keep pace because the profits and reinvestment are restricted. I think this goes a long way toward explaining the phenomenon of brownouts and blackouts in electricity. The profits of electric utilities, they've been under price control. They're a regulated legal monopoly, so it's understandable why there's price control. But you could have a controlled price that wouldn't curtail their production, provided the controlled price were high enough to give them a competitive rate of profit. If you have a controlled price that yields a competitive rate of profit, there will not be a shortage, at least not as a permanent situation, because it makes it possible to enlarge the supply to keep pace with the demand. But if you have a controlled price that prevents that, and the demand is growing, and inflation is further raising costs, well, then you'll have the demand outstripping the supply. And plus, here in California, in particular, the situation has been worsened by the fact that even to the extent that the power companies have wanted to build power plants, again and again, they've been prevented by environmentalism. So making the production of a good unprofitable or insufficiently profitable to keep pace with demand, that will result in shortages. But you can also have something unprofitable to the point where the industry will disappear. And there, rent control in New York City, I think, is a leading example. Rent control was imposed in New York City in 1943. And the controlled housing was subsequently allowed a few 15% rent increases. Meanwhile, what did inflation do to the costs of constructing and operating housing? It increased it radically, and so in case after case, the rent-controlled housing became more and more unprofitable, not even covering the operating costs. And when that occurs, what happens?
Extinct.
Pardon me?
Goes away.
Well, the housing becomes abandoned. And there were tens of thousands of apartments in New York City, particularly in the South Bronx, that were abandoned, where many fires were set to get the proceeds of insurance, I assume. I remember taking an elevated train ride in the South Bronx some years ago, and it reminded me of newsreel shots of Dresden, Germany after the Allied bombings. It was really a period, a scene of devastation. And you'd have to expect that if inflation continues jacking up the costs and the rates are frozen, well then more and more of the supply becomes unprofitable to maintain and it disappears. And to a large degree, in some places, rental housing has almost disappeared. Its place has been taken by co-ops and condominiums. I think the growth of co-ops and condominiums is very much a response to rent control or the threat of rent control. The idea of separate people owning pieces of one building doesn't make all that much sense. The logical procedure is a landlord owns the building and he rents the units. But if you have rent control, that threatens the profitability of rental housing, and so it encourages these other types. Making a local market uncompetitive. If you have price controls in some local markets, but not in all, and I think that was the case when we had price controls on oil, there were no price controls, I believe, in most of Western Europe and in Japan, which meant that when oil got scarcer and more expensive, its price could rise in those areas, but not here in the United States. So which areas, which area was deprived of supplies? The United States. We were made uncompetitive. The price control prevented us from matching the bids for oil with Japan and Western Europe. Now I refer to application to the surge in the price of wheat and soybeans. I mentioned that we've had tremendous agricultural surpluses because of the farm subsidy program, but in 1972 and 1973, most of these surpluses, at least for the time being, were suddenly swept out of the country, and there was actually serious concern whether there'd be enough grain remaining in the United States to meet domestic consumption. And the way this happened was we had price controls on just about everything at this time. And at the same time, there was a substantial devaluation of the dollar in terms of the major foreign currencies. So if we have a frozen price of grain and soybeans and so forth here in the United States, but suddenly the dollar costs substantially less, substantially fewer marks, yen, pounds, etc., what is the effect of that on the price of these goods in terms of marks, yen, and pounds? It suddenly drops, and then what happens to the quantities demanded?
Increase.
It goes up, and there's nothing to stop the increase. Now, just think, would exports normally ever be a threat to an adequate local supply in the United States? Would we normally ever have to worry about exporting something to the extent that we would not have enough for domestic consumption? What would guarantee adequate supplies for the domestic market? Pardon me? A free market. If we have a greater need for supplies here, the price rises. As the price rises, that diminishes the quantity of foreign of goods demanded from abroad, and it protects the supply here. But if the price is prohibited from rising, then is there anything that can operate to protect the domestic supply? No, then it is threatened. And then the next step to protecting it was to impose export embargoes. It's usually not recalled, but in the very same year that OPEC had this oil embargo against us, we imposed a soybean embargo against Japan. Not because we were deliberately out to wreck the Japanese economy, but because as the result of our price controls plus currency devaluation, there was a huge export of soybeans to Japan, and prohibiting the price of soybeans from rising, the only way to protect domestic supplies was to prohibit their further exportation. And then the aftermath of that was that the Japanese encouraged a great production of soybeans in Brazil. So our export ability was diminished thereafter. We had freezing weather in the Northeast, in New York, New Jersey, New England. There was a natural gas crisis in 1977. Schools had to close, factories had to close, because there was an acute shortage of natural gas. And hardly anyone saw the connection between price controls on interstate natural gas. At the time, the Federal Power Commission was controlling the interstate price of natural gas at something like 42 cents per cubic foot. Meanwhile, in Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma, where most of the natural gas is produced, they had an unregulated intrastate market where natural gas was selling at over a dollar a cubic foot. Now, if you're a producer in a place like Texas, Louisiana, or Oklahoma, and you can get a dollar a cubic foot in your home state, but you can only get 42 cents a cubic foot in New Jersey, where are you going to want to sell your gas? In your home market. And so the only supplies that moved were those that where there was a contractual obligation. Now, what would have served to move more supplies from the producing states to the states that had an urgent need for them? If the price had been allowed to rise, if you didn't have this price control. So price control prevented these northern markets from being competitive with the intrastate markets in Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma. There's a further point we already dealt with, making the consumption of a commodity too rapid and thus reducing future supply. This is the example: a crop comes in 1 month's 1 month below normal. If the price is allowed to rise, the shortfall can be spread over the entire year. If the price is prohibited from rising, consumption proceeds at its old rate, and then if we kept it up through 11 months, we'd have nothing left. We'd have a famine with that commodity in the 12th month. If we take it off at any intervening point, then the price has to rise higher than it otherwise would have, because the rate of restriction of consumption needs to be that much greater. Price control can reduce supply by making any given occupation or industry unable to compete for labor. Imagine, for example, that the government were trying to control some particular price. Let's say it wanted to control, for some reason, a private parcel delivery. So it wanted to control the rates of UPS and FedEx, the ground operations. Now, this would lead fairly soon to needing to control the wage rates of the UPS and FedEx drivers, because unless you want UPS and FedEx to go broke, having to pay rising costs, if you're controlling a price, pretty soon you'll need to control the further prices that constitute the costs. Well, what happens when you get to the point of controlling the wage rates of a given industry in order to keep its prices down?
They leave that industry,
the drivers for these delivery companies can drive for other companies. And if wage rates elsewhere are going up, then they'd be losing their labor, and this would undercut the operations of this price-controlled industry. Very similarly, E, making some products of a factor of production unable to compete with its other products. Suppose, for example, the government is concerned that poor families can't afford enough milk for their children, and it decides to make milk more affordable by imposing a price control. All right, well, this can simply deprive milk of its profitability and undercut its production. So suppose the government goes further and they not only control the retail price of milk, they control the price at the wholesale level and they control the price at the farm level. Even if they've done that much, what happens if they've left uncontrolled the price of cheese, ice cream, butter, and other milk products? How will the supply of milk be used?
More for the other products.
So they'd be cutting the supply of milk. That way, they'd be prohibiting milk from being competitive with other products of the same basic material. And that is the story, I think, in large measure, with conversions of apartment buildings from rental units to co-ops and condominiums. A given apartment building has these three different uses. It can be rental units, it can be co-ops, or it can be condominiums. Now, if you impose rent controls and you don't impose controls on the price of co-ops and condominiums, then which way will the available supply of apartments be used? For these alternatives. This is something that, surprisingly, the media doesn't seem to understand. I remember back in the 80s at some point, Los Angeles imposed rent control. I think maybe they've taken it off by now, but they allowed rates of increase that were higher than the rates that were actually occurring. So possibly they just became a dead letter. But in any case, practically the very next day, the media reported that landlords were suddenly converting their rental units to co-ops and condominiums. And they thought, this is a dreadful, evil act on their part. Well, is there any simple, logical explanation? If you deprive one use of something of its profitability, and you know that landlords are acting like any businessman to be profitable, not unprofitable, then what outcome should you expect? Who should bear the responsibility? The landlords for doing what comes naturally to them as profit-seeking businessmen, or the Los Angeles City Council for acting in defiance of that? I think it's obviously the Los Angeles City Council, not the landlords, for acting to be profitable. Okay, I see. Well, I'll just make my last observation, how price controls are equivalent to a prohibition of production. In New York, for example, the city government for all of these years would always say they'd like nothing better than to have more housing. They'd love more rental housing. What more could they desire more ardently? Well, that's all fine and well and good. The only thing is that by their behavior, they demonstrate that they don't want the housing to be profitable. Well, if you tell people, go ahead, please do it, you're welcome to, but we will prevent you from profiting from doing it, well, will anyone do it voluntarily? No. How does that differ in substance from making the activity illegal?
Not much.
It really doesn't. It's essentially the same thing. So you often have, I don't know if the concept of hypocrisy applies when it results from such profound, enormous, unfathomable ignorance. Okay, see you all next week.